I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome back, Martin.
Fabulous to be here, as always.
When you say here, Martin, where are we today? Sydney, Fremantle, Broome?
I'm in Broome, that lovely northern town in Western Australia. And so it's a great place to be in June, I think.
Well, you just about take a cross-country flight there, land in Brisbane, and on Sunday watch the Dockers win another match.
Well, for our Eastern States listeners, for which there are many, Michael, I did enjoy the State of Origin last night, which was an absolute thriller.
It's wrong of me to forget the great man went over the line with moments to go to secure probably the most famous Blues victory of all time, Martin.
I think I'd have to be. They were 20-0 down, so it was pretty astonishing.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about, Martin. Football actually is a great distraction from the things that worry you. The Fremantle Shipping News has been posting what I've been calling soothing photographs to distract people away from the ills of the world. But the weekly edition that goes out today has taken our shippies, our listeners, to the realities, Martin, to face up to what's happening, to brace up. I mean, we're going to talk about Iran and everything that involves. Talking about Poland and Trump's decision there, what on earth's going on in Alberta in Canada? If you thought that Tony Abbott had gone off to grow tomatoes, think again. If you thought the Teals weren't ever going to become a party, think again. If you think One Nation's not going to survive in this world, think again. If you thought Paul Brereton might never resign from the National Anti-Corruption Commission, think again, he has. And if you thought the Pope would probably take 10 years to bring out an encyclical of some moment, think again, he's done it. Martin, can I take you back to the latest in Iran? What do you make of it all? I mean, it sounds like classic Trump. Yes, no, maybe, possibly, we've got it under control.
Well, we had, again, you know, don't take note of his words, see what happens, because he told us repeatedly that we were very, very close to a deal. And it was imminent. And if you believe just what he's saying on social media, it was practically over the line, Michael. But once again, let's be a bit skeptical there because we haven't seen an agreement. Then lo and behold, what we're seeing is more fighting. And again, contested accounts around that. But it looks like US has launched a number of attacks, bombed several facilities in the southern part of Iran. So I think there's a reason for that. And Iran shot down a few drones.
It's amazing, isn't it? It was a fabulous headline in the New York Times the other day along the lines of Iran's teaching Trump how to do the big deal. And I think when the scholars sit down, the foreign affairs nerds, the people in Russell and foreign affairs and places in Canberra, they'll be studying this to work out exactly what happened. And they'll keep coming back to your point. Don't look at what people say so often is what they do. Well, one thing that he has said, and I think is going to happen, having withdrawn or said he was going to withdraw troops from Western Europe, from NATO, suddenly the other day, President Trump said he was sending 5,000 troops to Poland. A friend of mine suggested he wouldn't know what to do with them if they all went home. They have to be paid, so they might as well have a job to do and maybe go to Poland and do it. What do you reckon?
I think this is a very Trumpian decision. It's not without any logic. Let me explain. Firstly, there's that poor relationship with NATO generally that we see again and again. And, you know, that's manifesting itself in lots of different ways, the latest of which was Trump pulling troops out of Germany and France in particular, who've been quite critical. The German Chancellor was didn't mince words when asked about his view about the Iran war, was very critical, said it was ridiculous waste of resources. So Trump does like to punish people that criticise him, and he also likes rewarding people that are his friends or seem to be his friends. And there's a bit of this, isn't there? Clearly.
Isn't there?
Yeah.
Well,
So he's mates with the Prime Minister of Poland, isn't he?
The President of Poland. This is one
yeah,
of the
sorry,
countries.
My bad.
President. A lot of countries, the president gets elected but doesn't have any power. The prime minister, you'd expect, is more powerful. The Prime Minister's more on the liberal side. They've had a lot of politics up and down in Poland, but the president was supported when he was standing for re-election or election by Trump, and he won. So Trump thinks he's his mate.
There is another slight geopolitical thing here too, in that Poland spends a high percentage of its GDP on defence. And if you remember, Trump's big mantra is he expects all of his allies to spend more on defence, including Australia. So this might be his way of signalling that Poland's the good kid in the schoolyard and the others are bad kids in the schoolyard. So we're going to give you 5,000 extra troops because you're prepared to put stump up yourself.
You're a good guy. I think there's a lot in that. I say with respect, Martin. Now, I mean, countries in the world, if they were a country, for example, the province of Alberta in Canada, lots of oil, natural resources, gas, want to do deals. When the pipeline goes through to the US, they could afford to have a very large standing army. They could probably fly men to Mars. They'd be a significant player. And it sounds like a number of Albertans want to get out of the Confederation, whatever they call it. I've forgotten, Martin, the Canadian
Federation.
Constitution. Yes, so to get out of it. Have you followed this? I think goes back some decades.
It is really fascinating. And for all of our friends here in Western Australia, it's particularly fascinating because you've got a very similar, quite similar demographic here. Their population's 5 million in Alberta, a little bit more than us, but not a lot. Almost all of their population's toward the southern end in a couple of major cities. That being Edmonton and Calgary. Calgary's the biggest and further south. Sounds familiar, Michael. A big state, big mining state with all of its mining activity in the north and the wealth in the south. And of course, the argument coming out of Alberta, we make all the money and you, the feds, you take it away from us. And so there's not much love lost between Albertans and the central government in Ottawa, which is in the province of Ontario. So, a lot of similarities with Western Australia and the way we see Canberra sometimes.
Well, I have some real Australian students of Canadian politics, and particularly Alberta, because this goes back for decades and decades. They've always voted a bit differently in these Western provinces. I see Mark Carney, the Canadian PM, started using references to Brexit, the famous pulling out by the UK of the EU. And you can sort of imagine it, that you could have a buyer's regret if you all voted and went. And he's not happy with the fact that they're even having a referendum on it, which the Alberta Premier has supported. I suppose the idea is, like Cameron all those years ago, let's have it. People won't vote for it, and we'll get it out of the system for the next 30 or 50 years.
You know what's curious again about the separatist movement that's a bit similar to what concerns in WA? There's a big fiscal element to it, which is not as prominent in most separatist movements. All of it's around identity. This is about whether they get a good deal from the federal government, whether they'd be better off on their own. It would be a very strange scenario if you look at the map of Canada. To the left is Canada, to the right is Canada, to the northern part is Canada. It's really surrounded by the rest of Canada. So it would be a strange phenomenon to see Alberta actually become independent.
Well, I suspect they'd still want a big Albertan ice hockey team playing in the big matches, just to be able to show the rest how powerful and strong they are. Do you have any sense of what the flow-on effect might be if Alberta were to think about going? As you say, there's a big gap between British Columbia, as you look at the map on their left, and all the other provinces going across: Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Ontario, Quebec, and then all of the maritime provinces. What did you think BC would decide? Well, we'll go too.
Well, it's a possibility. The other one, of course, is Quebec, which is French speaking and does have significant cultural differences. I reckon the biggest fear in Ottawa would be around the collapse of the Federation if that were to occur. So they're already ramping up the rhetoric, Michael. They're comparing it to Brexit.
Well, it's going to be interesting. And as you say, in the 1930s, West Australians, or a good number of them, wanted to secede from the Commonwealth. Maybe, yes, we'll see some ricochets of that here. Martin, I'll take you to another topic, a political party in Australia that seems to be struggling at the moment. We'll talk more about One Nation apparently surging in the polls. The Liberal Party's still struggling, it seems, by all accounts. But they're bringing back Tony Abbott. What's that all about?
There is a reason. I think there's a rationale, but there's a risk. I'll start telling you the rationale first. Whilst the teal seats are important to the Liberals in winning government, the seats that they're in danger of losing to One Nation are existential because that's their base. It's a conservative political party. These are the conservative seats in outer suburban, particularly regional areas, which could be lost to One Nation. And there's polls that suggest that it could be reduced to a rump seat, rump of less than a dozen seats in a 150 seat parliament if things really go badly for them. That's their thinking here. That's what they're really worried about here. Tony Abbott is famous for a lot of things, but he did see off One Nation 1.0 as a member of the Howard government. And I think they're really hoping that he will appeal to those One Nation voters and help send them off again. That's the rationale. There's a risk. And the risk is Tony Abbott might think he's bigger than Ben-Hur and try and overshadow Angus Taylor at every turn and use that as a real platform for his own agenda. So I'd be very nervous if I was Angus Taylor about this. I think there's a, you know, you've got to retain control over policy in the party room.
There's a lot of commentary about the fact that Abbott has, after he left the parliament and not altogether happily, looked at ways of getting himself back into the parliament. I suppose this would be a nice, broad stepping stone.
It's not out of the question. Of course, you know, of course, he didn't leave by choice. He got bumped out by the voters, famously in Warringah. So I think he definitely would mind another crack at it, and he's not ruled it out either. So I mean, that's definitely he may see that as a platform back in.
We've assumed that all of our listeners appreciated that Abbott's next step here is to become the president of the Liberal Party, so a non sitting role but having influence within the party. You've mentioned the Teals and the sort of metropolitan seats they hold, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, and then there's suddenly been talk and another former Liberal Prime Minister has been attached to the talk, Malcolm Turnbull. But the Teals should become a party after all. And the motivation seems to be that this is a way of protecting you as a group of people from the difficult political financing laws that are coming in, which will restrict how much you can spend if you remain individuals. What do you make of what's happening? Because not all of the so-called Teals have put their hands up for the idea.
I think it's quite a challenging idea. I probably wouldn't be joining it if I was a teal, and there's a reason. Part of your appeal that you've spent all of your time advertising yourself and your brand is that you're a community independent, and the independent brand is part of their attraction. If you become part of a party, you're suddenly bound to all the things that are there in the party. And these teals, even though there's some similarities in demographics, they are in different areas quite a bit. I'll give you one example. When it comes to their position on anti-Semitism, or more particularly around Israel and Gaza, etc., the member for Wentworth, Allegra Spender, she's overseeing the largest Jewish community in Australia. She'll have a different view on that issue to some of the other Teals, which is normal and natural. As so you join a political party, you end up being beholden to the fortunes of other members of that party. They do the wrong thing, then suddenly you're in the poo as well. So it's I would think there's good reason why some of them have reservations.
And as you say, it would constrain the ability of the individual so-called Teals to express their opinions on anything. You might think that they've got a lot in common, and they do seem to have because they all seem to be reasonable, sensible women. But when the proverbial hits the fan, Martin, you sometimes can be really constrained by a party setup, as we know from watching the Liberals, the Country Party, and the Labor Party.
I think that they might have to find that they have to compromise their own positions, which runs counter to everything they've said. So I think there's a real challenge in that. And you know the sort of ringmaster, if you like, which is David Pocock, who has a fantastic reputation and well regarded, but he is that senator for the ACT, and Canberra is a very different place to a lot of other metropolitan areas.
Well, we shouldn't forget either that Helen Haynes, a highly influential member of that so-called Teals group, she doesn't like the idea of forming the party, nor does Monique Ryan, and Kate Chaney said she doesn't either. So that's at least three. I haven't caught up with any later pronouncements of you.
No, I think that's about right. I mean, Helen Haynes has a rural seat. Her seat has very little in common with the other seats. So I'm not surprised that she wasn't keen.
Martin, we've been charting the fortunes of One Nation for some time now. When we got to the pointy end, saw how they did reasonably well in South Australia, if not quite well. And then, of course, they won big time in Farrer. And now we see recent opinion polls suggesting that they're on the up and up. Can you tell us a bit about those opinion polls? I've asked you before, can you trust opinion polls? And if you can, what do you make of these?
Just remember, my usual mantra on opinion polls is it's a snapshot of public opinion at a point in time. That last bit's important. And so that point of time can change. But right at this point in time, One Nation continues to poll really well. And its poll in percentage is at the moment close, well past coalition and close to Labor. So they're around about 28% to Labor's 31. If you look at the full suite of the party, the main parties, and then tried to break them down into seats. And Redbridge has tried to do this. Now, I'm not entirely sure it's 100% accurate for a variety of reasons, including independent votes and the like, right? But it would have Labor winning 76, which is a very slim majority in a 150-seat parliament, basically right on the knife edge. 59 for One Nation, and 12 for the coalition. So, that would be an extraordinary result. It would basically mean we have a new, completely new opposition party in One Nation, and the coalition's almost irrelevant.
I mean, do you believe it? Is it to be explained simply because people are a bit pissed off, to coin an expression? Is it likely to sort of revert to some old normality sometime soon? Or do you think we've actually broken the damn wall and we're all rushing down the Murrumbidgee?
Well, we've had in the first instance some test here in Farrer and in South Australia where the vote for One Nation's kind of held. In fact, in Farrer, it was higher than was expected. So that bodes well for One Nation. But Victoria will be a different type of test because that's a fairly progressive state on the whole. If that poll really well in Victoria, both the major parties should be very concerned. Because there's a lot of federal seats in Victoria as well. Now, South Australia has a lot less.
Now, it's always struck me that one of the big problems if for One Nation, if they start picking up some momentum, is getting quality candidates. People otherwise look around and, in respect of many people, think, oh, I wonder if they could even run a school touch shop properly. What's their experience in life? How do they compare to the sort of candidates the major parties put up, who are usually pretty impressive? I suppose there's going to have to be a whole lot of learning and discipline. And it sounds like Pauline Hanson and her leading group are up for the discipline.
I think there is a more professional element to One Nation than we've seen previously, and they've even booted some people out for extreme points of view there in the party, and they'll need to be if they want to be taken seriously as a major contender. I still think there will be those issues around candidates. You can't suddenly go from no candidates to 150 candidates and expect all of them to be above board, professional, no baggage, all of those things. I reckon they're going to run into some headwinds there. And I don't know if Pauline, for all of her other charisma, so to speak, has got a good track record in managing people, Michael.
I suppose we're likely to see a range of people who think, oh, this is my chance. I want to be in Parliament. I tried getting in with the Labor Party, but they weren't all that interested in me. I looked at the Teals and they were too teal coloured for me. Maybe I'll just put aside some of my misgivings and show my CV to these people at One Nation, a little bit like, as I see it, the fellow who won Farrer. Do you think that might happen?
It can happen, and there's two types. There might be someone that was nervous about entering politics before, but now sees an opportunity and might do quite well. But there's also that danger that people that were, for want of a better word, a bit of a crackpot, Michael, who couldn't get a run in any of the majors and now see this as their opportunity. So they've got to really be careful about weeding out plenty of those.
It's going to be very interesting. We'll keep watching. Martin, as I think many of our listeners know, and I've disclosed before, I'm on the board of a body called the Centre for Public Integrity, and we were very much, as an organisation, great advocates for the creation of the National Anti-Corruption Commission. And people like the aforementioned Helen Hames, amongst the independent crossbenchers, was a very strong parliamentary force to establish this body. But not everybody was all that happy when Paul Brereton was appointed the commissioner, and they were even less happy when the robo-debt matters that Commissioner Catherine Holmes had considered in a royal commission were not taken on by the NAC. And there's been grumbling and 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 a bit more grumbling and grumbling. And the other day, Paul Brereton decided he had enough and he's resigned. He's been before a Senate's estimate committee, and he's obviously, depending on which journalist you read, not entirely happy about the way he's being treated. But it seems to be a significant move for him to go. The NAC seems to have lost a little bit of public support, not so much support, but people having confidence that it's actually ever going to do anything useful.
And this is a really important one to discuss because the NAC's been a long time coming, National Anti-Corruption Commission. A lot of people have been pushing for it. It was these new institutions tend to be judged heavily on how they perform at the outset. And so there's a bit of a danger that in not getting this right, NAC's purpose and value could be undermined, and then leads it to susceptible to abolition when a government wants to avoid accountability, Michael, which is not that uncommon. So I think this was always a difficult appointment in Paul Brereton. It's not that he wasn't competent or had some capabilities. The Brereton report into the soldiers in Afghanistan, for instance, was quite interesting. But from the very start, he was bedeviled with allegations of conflict of interest. And that's always an issue, but it's a bigger issue if you're heading up the major anti-corruption commission. Because guess what they investigate? Conflicts of interest. You just can't have that. The person has to be completely beyond reproach. I really hope that they get the next part of this really right, because you've got to have your public voice on. He was retreating from the public domain, Michael, because he knew that this was an issue. We need to flip that, and the NAC head has to be the person prosecuting the case for NAC existing, and being able to talk up what they're doing and why. They also need to probably get some high-profile outcomes as well. And I think that's probably the other part that the incoming NAC head will be seeking to focus on.
There's a range of bodies, including the Centre for Public Integrity, who are advocating for the engagement of rigorous application and assessment and appointment processes now, because you have to make sure that you know who's there, that you worked out who's there, and have a fairly transparent appointment process, I think, Martin.
I think that's really important, and it's important everywhere, but it's particularly important for this appointment.
All right, well, we'll wait and see what happens next. It's a difficult time for an organisation like this. The public have a huge sort of store of confidence in them to do the right job. And certainly the robo-debt decision that Paul Brereton had a lot to do with was a bad start. But what do you think of the start, the first encyclical of Leo, the Pope Leo the 14th?
I think it's a great move. I think it's overdue, and I think it's a really interesting development. Just a bit of context here for listeners. This is an encyclical on the risks to humanity of artificial intelligence. There couldn't be a better time to release this because we're right at the cusp. It's right around now. Just in the last 2 years, probably, it's really hit the market. And user interfaces exploded. But it raises profound implications. And at the core of his thesis is AI is a tool that humans should master the tool, not become a slave to the tool. And if it all goes pear-shaped, actually, we'll end up becoming enslaved to it. It will be making the judgments. And where is the humanity in all of this? I'll give you one example, Michael, very quickly. There's a lot of jobs where if you apply for those, AI will decide whether you get shortlisted based on algorithms. And so you might have a fantastic case to make and be a really interesting applicant, but you probably never get to the shortlist before a human actually sets eyes on your application. This is not uncommon. A lot of, shelf stacking at Woolies or something like that, right? Imagine if that starts becoming the modus operandi for decision making more and more. If there's one thing, soft skill that we need from our leaders, it's good decision making and good judgment. And I think that's just one example about how we can become, in the drive to become ever more efficient, we actually become slaves to to AI.
As you give that example, Martin, I think to myself, well, I just assume in this new AI world that every applicant for that job at Woolies and every other job on the planet, applicants who want to do this course or that course at Notre Dame University, for example, will have AI do their applications for them, and they'll know the algorithms, and they'll be sort of pinging each other with the same catchphrases, the same little bits that are going to make a difference.
And that's absolutely possible. And that, for me, that would be a bleak dystopian future if we're judging people entirely on some AI slop that they've produced. And I'm not against AI per se. I think you get it to write, pro forma emails, those sorts of things. You get it to answer queries, all that kind of stuff. It might write up tables for you. It can be used and used really well. But the encyclical here does speak to the dangers if you're not really clear-eyed and strategic about how you approach it.
What should the ordinary reader do when it comes to something like the encyclical? And I mean, it raises a very interesting question about what the Pope's role here is. Once upon a time, as I recall the way these things would work 100 years ago, if the Pope went to the trouble of making an encyclical, everyone fell to their knees and people said what the actual words were in it, and it was treated as holier script than the Holy Script. And you did it. What's the role here? Is he trying to back at political leaders? Is this just purely a moral argument?
I think it's more of a, it's designed more as a moral argument than a political one. But of course, you can't truly separate the two in many respects. By a moral argument, it's designed to say, well, we're morally, we can't be enslaved to a non-human tool. And our humanities must remain central to everything that we have. But politically, of course, when in emphasizing people's humanity, you are pushing against the grain. And there's a lot of money making to be made in AI, and it's already happening. And it's already a really burgeoning industry. So, you are taking on various centers of power in all of this that I think is an interesting one to watch, I suspect.
Well, already a number of the commentators are saying, well, if you look for guidance by way of what the responses are from Silicon Valley and the big tech people, and you look at the stock market, the answers are all there. They're not going to read the encyclical much. But the other thing that interests me is that people throw around the concept, the expression Tower of Babel, Martin, in all of this. And I'll have to dig deep into my religious knowledge here, but the biblical knowledge. And there's a lot of debate still, I think, about whether there was a real Tower of Babel and whether it's all mythical and the like. But the concept's clear enough. It's a little bit like a version of hubris. Some temporal ruler wants to build this huge thing and have everybody do what he says. God's a bit worried about that, Yahweh. So he knocks the Tower of Babel down. But the actual human example of all of this is that's apparently when we stop speaking the one language on the planet and we started speaking different languages. And I thought to myself when I was sort of remembering this that God's got a lot to answer for. He should reverse us all to speaking the same language. And that might solve a lot of our problems, Martin.
Yes, I think that's an interesting analogy there. But I think it does. There is a profound question here, right? Who's the boss? Are we answerable to AI, or is AI answerable to us? If AI is answerable to us and it's a useful tool that makes our life easier and more efficient, that's fabulous. If all that happens is we're suddenly a slave to the algorithms that we have, you and I have talked about political polarization in the past. It's not disconnected from these algorithms that are fed to us by social media that reinforces bias and the biases and prejudice we already have. So we're already being kind of influenced and manipulated by algorithms. And I think AI may just accelerate that, exacerbate that.
It's going to be one of the big issues. I'm lucky that I've got four granddaughters. They can have to, well, they'll probably have to perforce resolve these issues, Martin, over the years ahead. But everything races ahead at such a pace, you hardly have time to consider either the morality or the technical aspects, or if someone's already using it to produce, design and produce new warheads to take control of the world. But I guess we'll just have to keep talking about it and thank the Pope for doing his encyclical.
Well, these things are needed. You know, for me, I think there's a lack of moral clarity. And I never give moral clarity to one person, Michael. I'm not that kind of think person. But I think having a voice like this that does cause us to pause and reflect is not a bad thing.
Well, Martin, that's a lot that we've covered today. Thank you for joining me. I better let you get back down to Cable Beach for an early morning swim.
Yes, well, I'll definitely be just trying out the waves there while I'm here for sure.
See you next Friday.
Pleasure as always.